Shrink Wrap Radio number 542, Archetype and Psyche in Crisis and Growth, with Tim Reed, MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with London psychiatrist Dr. Tim Reed about his book, Walking Shadows, Archetype and Psyche in Crisis and Growth. For more information about Dr. Tim Reed, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Tim Reed, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, hello, Dr. Dave. It's great to be here and great to meet you.
Well, likewise, I'm really pleased, particularly because I'm so impressed by your book, Walking Shadows, Archetype and Psyche in Crisis and Growth. So let me start off by asking you, how did you come up with Walking Shadows? And what's that supposed to communicate?
Well, Walking Shadows was quite a late title. I think the process of finding a title is often quite a long, complicated path. And I say quite a lot about Plato's cave, which I think provides a very nice story that illustrates what archetypes are. And of course, one of the important parts of Plato's cave is for people look at the three-dimensional shadows.
Of course. Now I get it. Plato's cave runs throughout the book. Yeah.
And then there's another reference actually in Macbeth, which is about, which I think refers to quite a deep layer of depression. I suppose it, one of the deeper layers of depression, which is about full of fury, we are but walking shadows. I forget the exact quote. There's something which is full of pain and rage.
Okay.
And so quite a lot of the book is about really intense mental states, these intensely charged archetypal states, and how difficult they can be, and how can we start to heal the more destructive, difficult, challenging parts of those, which I think is what the Macbeth quote refers to.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you how you would describe your book, but maybe you just did.
Well, the clue is in the subtitle, so I'm trying to tease out what are archetypes and how it informs our understanding of psychiatry and the journeys that we find ourselves taking through our lives. And you know, I've always found it really quite difficult to understand what archetypes are. Certainly, in my psychiatric training and my training in psychoanalytical psychotherapy, it was not a term that was used. So I think the term archetype is quite a helpful way of trying to understand parts of the deeper layers of the psyche, the great big currents of meaning and how they flow through us, and how sometimes it can be particularly charged and sometimes very challenging, sometimes very enlightening and beautiful, sense of sacred. So the first part of the book is really trying to tease out the nature of archetypes, and with some reference to Plato's cave and what Jung went through with his creative crisis and
sure.
quantum physics.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really strikes me about the book that runs throughout it, kind of for me, what the organizing principle was, is that you're talking about extreme mental states, and those can either lead to a very positive experience or to a very negative experience, since we are talking about extremes. So, so what I really like about this book is that you theoretically link those, throughout the book. And so I found that a very useful synthesis. And you write that you have an unconventional take on psychiatry. And I would say that's true based from reading the book, but what would you say about that?
Well, there's a lot of psychiatry which I think is really helpful. But psychiatry essentially thinks that consciousness is a neurochemical process, that we are a function of our neuronal connections. The process begins when we're born, and finishes when we die. And consciousness is confined to the limits of our skull, the bony confines of our skull. And I'm generally persuaded by the more transpersonal view that it's a lot more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that conventional psychiatry, psychoanalysis is really helpful in many ways, but it's a bit like Newtonian physics. And of course, we know, you know, at the end of the 19th century, the classical certainties were shattered really by the discovery of quantum physics, and physicists discovered that the nature of the physical universe was just so much more complicated than had previously been imagined. Of course, what physicists are great at is they're great at finding evidence that persuade other physicists. So the consensus view of reality moves quite smoothly from Newtonian physics to quantum physics. That has not happened in psychiatry. So we've known for many years that there are certain mental states, visionary states, etc., that are not well accounted for by conventional psychiatry, cognitive neuroscience, psychoanalysis, and these models are helpful as far as they go, but they don't give us a full picture.
Yeah, you know, just stepping back a moment, I'm remembering that part of your training is in group psychoanalysis. And that was interesting to me because I was very involved when I was in graduate school in what was called T groups, which, yeah. I maybe came out of London in the Tavistock clinic there. I don't know if that rings a bell.
Sure.
And so T groups and counter groups, and that was very formative for my own personal experience. And I'm wondering if group psychoanalysis was somehow swimming in that same pond.
I think group psychoanalysis is a more gentle, gradual process. So it's like psychoanalysis, but instead of being a single child in one parent family, you're part of a big, noisy, sometimes squabbling, but essentially fairly healthy family. So my group analysis, for example, I went to my group twice a week for an hour and a half for about 5 years. And you go through a whole range of processes.
So you were with a group of other trainees?
No, it was a group of interested people. So okay. It was a group of people who wanted to do that level of work on themselves. And I suppose what it did for me was it really demonstrated conclusively to me that there were parts of my psyche in which I was completely unconscious, but which were affecting me in quite a profound way. And one of the things that group work gives you that other psychoanalytic methods don't is some understanding of the sibling process. So just to give you an example of that, I was, after I'd been in the group for 6 months or so, someone left and a new group member was to join. And I was aware that I felt very uncomfortable in quite a subtle way that I didn't really understand.
Sure.
I mean, I realized after a while it was just a reenactment of my mother getting pregnant, and her attention being diverted to the pregnancy and my little sister who was in utero. And all those feelings came up to the surface, all those sibling rivalry, the feelings that you have when you're a 2-year-old. So I was very impressed by that sort of visceral reenactment and putting some of these things to rest.
Yeah, that's one of the things that runs through your book as well that I really appreciate is you have been a meticulous explorer, both intellectually but also experientially. So you've kind of put yourself through various trainings and workshops and so on to really explore from an inside way all of the topics that you're exploring as much as you could. And that orientation is something I share. I think you've taken it even further than I did in my life, but I really appreciate that aspect.
Well, it's great to hear that you're similar minded. I mean, it seems to me that I think we have to do this. I think it behoves us in a way to understand the territories which we're hopefully guiding our patients through in a useful way. Mm-hmm. And that was what Jung did, of course, when Jung went through his creative crisis. That was really the making of him, although it was nearly the breaking of him as well. But what Jung went through was really heavy duty, and he barely survived it. So obviously you wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah.
So I suppose one of the questions I've been asking is, how can you do something a little similar to what Jung did, but in a safer, more digestible form?
Mm-hmm. Now, clearly you've been influenced by the Jungian perspective, and yet you're not a Jungian analyst, right?
No, I'm not a Jungian analyst. It was something I looked at, but it seemed to me the Jungian trainings available in London were not really very Jungian and did not really take you to, you know, the heart of what Jung was working with, which was a really creative encounter with the deep unconscious.
Mm-hmm. You describe your work as following a bio-psycho-social archetypal model. So that's a very long hyphenated phrase. You want to say just a little bit about that?
So in British psychiatry, we tend to use the biopsychosocial model, which is a much more holistic model than the purely biological psychiatry model. So the biopsychosocial model, you recognise that we have some biological genetic vulnerabilities, which I think we all have to some extent, which are greater in some than others. And of course, we can heighten those by the use of substances like high strength cannabis. For example, and then we have obviously our psychological issues, our psychological vulnerabilities, and then there's a social setting. So that's the normal sort of concept with which we would try to understand what people are going through. If you add archetypal to that, I think it gives you something extra. I think it maybe gives you a way of understanding the meaning. If you consider archetypes as the deep layers of meaning, meaning is like another dimension. So it helps you to really sort of focus on the meaning of what people are going through, not the developmental meaning, not the issues of abandonment necessarily, but the deeper layers of meaning. Maybe it helps you to engage that process a little bit more fully. And of course, one of the ideas about the archetypal concept is that if you can engage with it, if you can work with it, it's a creative process that if it's handled properly will be growth orientated.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody asked me not long ago why I was so interested in the Jungian perspective. And what came up for me was that they value mystery, that it's not a totally closed system that sort of accounts for everything.
Yeah. So Jung agreed with Freud that Freud's ideas had some merit, but he thought there was a bigger picture.
Now, we should let people know that much of your work is based on working with clients in London's East End who are in acute state of crisis. And I guess, not knowing London that well, except as a tourist, I guess the East End is what would be the worst part of a city here in the U.S., a dangerous section of the city to be in.
Well, it's the old working class area, so it's generally where the poor people come. So it's always been a bit of a melting pot to get the immigrants. So it's a more edgy area.
What have you learned from doing that work in the East End? It sounds like it was an important part of your development, as opposed to a more ivory tower kind of place to work.
So I was there for 20 years. I worked in emergencies for that time, really. So I really felt so I was at the coalface of whatever happens in the human psyche. And there were three main categories of patients that I would see. There was the crisis service, which was people who had been suicidal but were not psychotic. And these were people that had been through what I would say was a numinous experience of feeling hopeless and dreadful and wanting to kill themselves. And then they come out of that and they want to address their issues. So they find their way to us, and we work with them using an adaptation of psychoanalytical issues often. And then there were people who I used to see in the emergency room who were often psychotic. And some of these people would be able to conceptualize the idea of it being a personal journey, but that would be pretty unusual. most of the people would think that the problem was out there, be hearing voices, they'd be deluded, etc. So there's some real sort of question marks about how can you work creatively with these people. The first issue is to, you know, to make them safe, is to take care of them in a decent and humane way. But then the question is, how can you do more than that? How can you help them to integrate their material in a way that might be useful, might give them some protection against future episodes, etc. And then the third category was the people who were brought into the trauma wards, because the hospital served as had a helicopter ambulance service that served London. So we would get all the people that had survived jumps from high places or very severe forms of self-harm. And I did a little project looking at about 200 of those people. And as one would expect, about 70% of them had some psychiatric disorder, you could say they're mentally ill or something, which left 30% who were essentially normal by the time I got to see them on the trauma ward. And of those 30%, half of those, one could understand the reason why they had done what they had done. It was understandable. Maybe there'd been a relationship breakup or reenactment of some past psychological trauma or something of that nature. But that left another 15%, which is about 30% of the total sample, that really I had no idea. It was very difficult to understand why they had done what they had done. And they really seemed to defy any sort of classification. And the closest that I could get to understanding it was people seemed to describe it as like a bad trip, which had happened spontaneously, obviously without taking any substance, often triggered by something relatively mild. Maybe there'd been a meeting at work that, you know, hadn't gone very well, but then things had escalated, so they'd gone into a place of really dark intensity, full of, you know, hopelessness and horror and worthlessness, and they had done what they had done. And then by the time I actually see them, their mental state is recovered and they're pretty much back to normal. And so I try and work with them and try to figure out with them, you know, what's going on for them and why they got into this place and, you know, how we can work with it. But with this group of people, I couldn't do that. I just couldn't engage with them. They really seemed to shut down. It seemed as though the intensity of what they'd been through, the sheer awfulness of it, had seared them, so they remained shut. So I was very interested by that. This is something that, you know, you don't see in the textbooks. It was new to my experience, and, you know, it raised all sorts of questions to me. Why did this happen? Why did it happen to these particular people? Why did it snap out of it so quickly? How can you work with them?
Right. So you were, by working in a trauma environment, you were seeing a lot of people who were experiencing what you call intense mental states. And you write that those states are conducive to change. And I've always thought in terms of altered states of consciousness as being conducive to change. Usually I was thinking of it in a positive context, but what becomes clear is it can go either way, depending upon a lot of factors. And I think there's a growing awareness in psychotherapy now, the truth of that emotional, strong emotions can help drive change. And one of the things that comes to mind is the research on memory reconsolidation, that memories can be shaped and changed if there's strong emotion around rehearsing it.
Yeah.
And as I've mentioned, one of the things that you and I share is an interest in the Jungian perspective, ideas such as archetype, psyche, meaning, synchronicity, and so on. But one of the things I liked about the book is that you hold these ideas lightly as opposed to dogmatically. I tend to be that way myself. I don't seem to be able to muster up being a true follower. So these things interest me. So I really appreciate that. In the book, I get a sense that it's something that you sometimes struggle with, as I have. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we become exposed to so many ideas, and, you know, looking back on my life as a psychiatrist, I think I've become more aware now of how powerful marketing is. Maybe you don't realize it at the time, but it's becoming clearer now that some of the information upon which we based our prescribing decisions was not accurate information. Certainly when I was a very young trainee psychiatrist, you see people who are unhappy, you want to make them better. So you offer them a tablet and maybe you have unrealistic expectations of how they work. And when I was doing my psychoanalytical training, there's some ideas I was very fond of. So you explore those ideas, maybe you become a bit over-identified with them, and then you move on to something else. And I suppose I continue to do that, but each time you identify with a set of new ideas, maybe you identify with it a little bit less, and it finds a more subtle place among the array of other ideas, and it's about putting it all together in a useful way.
Yeah, it sounds like the process of getting more conservative in a way as we age, based on experience, right? I mean, yeah, I've seen so many things come and go, and enthusiasms that peak and claims that are too extreme. And so we reach a place where, I think we also share a capacity for being enthusiastic.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, if you're working with people, the most important thing is to be interested.
Yeah.
To be interested in this other human being that is before you. And it has to be a kind of heartfelt presence, I think. I think you have to have a genuine sense of compassion, interest in their story. You want to help them in their personal journey. If you stop feeling that, then that's a bit of burnout. And do something about it. And I guess that's something that we all go through to a greater or lesser extent at some stage.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned earlier on, you kind of touched on this, that you were strongly influenced by Plato on the one hand and David Bohm and the new physics, I guess, quantum physics on the other. So say a bit more about how these two seemingly very different perspectives separated by 1,000 or more years, how do those speak to you?
Well, I think Plato gives us a really wonderful story that indicates what archetypes might actually be and how they work and how archetypal consciousness sort of fits with our biopsychosocial consciousness, if you like. So in the story of Plato's cave, you've got four levels, really. You've got the level of consensus reality, which is the people chained in position looking at the wall upon which flickering images are played. And the next level up is the effigies, which are paraded in front of the firelight, which creates the images. And the effigies really represent our conditioning, the conditioning which is given to us from our biographical history, our developmental conditioning, as well as other layers of conditioning. And then you've got the outside world beyond the cave, which has got the extra dimensions. It's three-dimensional, it has colour, it's a more primary reality. So this is more archetypal reality. And then you've got the top level, at the apex of the pyramid, which is the sun, from which everything comes, which equates to the Jungian concept of a self-archetype, equates to the Atman Brahman concept. The other way in which the story is really helpful is it tells us a bit about the ascent out of the cave. So what happens when one of the figures looking at the back of the cave starts making his way up the cave, and he has an encounter with the effigies, which is really uncomfortable. It's a numinous experience of a challenging kind. Usually Plato says you would want to retreat from that. You'd want to go back to where you started from. You would want to continue the journey. If you do continue the journey, you go beyond that. You go to a much lighter, more beautiful place. You go from an ominous experience to a more numinous experience. And you become aware of the primary energy of the archetypal self. And then Plato says something about the journey back down into the cave. You know, how do you communicate the message of the primary reality outside, the self-archetype? And of course, Plato says that You can do that badly. You can make a mess of it. If you go back into the cave, your eyes aren't going to work very well because they've been blinded by the light. You're going to be trying to describe the indescribable, and you're probably not going to make a lot of sense. And if you're not careful, people are going to turn on you.
This reminds me of Joseph Campbell's Journey of the Hero, and absolutely, and the last stage of that is trying to come back and to share the boon, share whatever insight you had.
Yeah. On the subject of Campbell, I mean, Campbell says that he's the world's great collator of myths and understanding myths, and he says that myths are the secret gateway through which the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos come through to us and take shape.
Yeah.
Which links to David Bohm, really, because he was the quantum physicist who developed the idea of consciousness being an integral part of the stuff of the universe. So he gave us this idea that meaning really is like a fifth dimension, and meaning and matter unfold out of the same primary stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he also suggests that in the same way that there are frequencies that our ears can't hear, the wavelengths that our eyes can't see.
Right.
There's a whole range of meaning that our brain can't really pick up. And a number of other people have suggested that our cognitive apparatus, our brain, really confines our experience of meaning to actually quite a narrow range.
Yes.
And if we go out of that meaning range, it's really difficult. And you know, I think this is what a lot of people with so-called psychiatric disorders experience.
Yeah, that touches on one of the things that one of the points in the book is that people can become overwhelmed by meaning. Now, that's not something I ever thought of in those terms. Generally, meaning is a good thing. How can meaning be a bad thing?
Well, if you look at people with psychiatric states, someone's depressed, they have a really intense feeling of doom and gloom and guilt and worthlessness and hopelessness, and they are overwhelmed by the meaning of that. If they have a different sort of condition, it might mean more to do with persecutory anxiety and fear and the sense that something terrible is going to happen to them. You know, if they have a manic state, then it might be much more joy-filled and light-filled and sense of being one with God and cosmic oneness. If you've got post-traumatic stress disorder, the imminence of catastrophe, being overwhelmed by that meaning that something really horrible is happening and your world becomes a very dangerous place.
Yeah, so meaning kind of varies on an affective continuum, it sounds like, that there's both the content of the meaning, but also there's the emotional impact.
Yes.
Continuum.
So, if you do work in non-ordinary states of consciousness, well, you know, if you take a psychedelic inappropriate stressful setting or holotropic breathwork or something, then this tends to accentuate the meaning. So it takes us to a greater amplification of meaning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a term that you used that I had not encountered anywhere else was archetypal penetrance states. You want to expand that a little bit for us? The penetration of the archetype somehow.
Yes. So the term penetrance is a term from genetics, and it describes the way that a genetic tendency becomes translated into a physical characteristic. And some genes are completely penetrant. So if you've got the gene, you will have the hair or the physical characteristic or whatever, but most genes have got incomplete penetrance. So I've just used that term to try to understand how archetypal intensity is very variable. We can have high archetypal penetrant states where we enter the higher range of meaning. They can be primitive high archetypal penetrant states, which can be difficult to manage. You can feel overwhelmed, or they can be more stable, high archetypal penetrant states. So if you're feeling particularly open, maybe if you're on holiday, beautiful nature, coming back from meditation retreat in a position of physical intimacy or something. Or you can be in a low archetypal penetrant state where life becomes very contracted and meaning states are sort of grey and narrow and not much is going on.
You know, your book covers so much ground that we're not going to be able to touch on everything that's in it. So I'm going to kind of skip around on, to some of the topics that I was particularly interested in. And so one thing I want to talk about is the idea of numinosity. You've used that term a couple of several times already in our discussion. In one way that was unexpected to me when you paired it with distress, and I tend to think of things as being numinous in a good way, but I guess it has more dimensionality than the way that I thought of it.
Yeah, so the term comes from a German theologian who wrote about 100 years ago, and he was interested in numinous experience, and he found that, so from he described numinous as having a sense of the sacred, a sense of being filled with awe. Mm-hmm. The sense of sacred is not synonymous with goodness. It can be dread-filled. It can be ominous rather than numinous. Uh-huh. Dread-filled states, he felt, were primitive versions. And if you can support these primitive dread-filled states, the numen unfolds and is transcended, and you move from a really difficult area to a beautiful area. And this is what you find in practice. And he described how numinous states can sweep in like the tide, or they can come in abruptly. They're huge. They seem like something other. They seem like something separate from ourselves. Doesn't seem like something from our own psyche. Very difficult to describe, ineffable, difficult to put into words. So he's the father of numinous states, if you like.
Okay, now I didn't know about him and never read him, and so my own sort of private interpretation, I don't know how private, but I've tended to think of that word as referring to things that have sort of a psychic charge, things that are out there, but they somehow connect strongly to something within ourselves. So, for example, I would say that I find pocket knives for me, or knives, are very numinous. Mm-hmm. And I could, you know, free associate, I have, you know, to try to, okay, what's that about? Or pocket watches. And one of the things I've come up with, at not so much a archetypal level, but a personal historical one, is they remind me of a grandfather, and and put me in touch with a kind of masculinity. And so I think that's why they just they grab my interest.
Yeah. So that's a personal experience that would have a charge for you. I mean, a really high level numinous experience would take you completely beyond yourself.
Yeah. Well, I've tried to look into it a little more. For example, that a knife can be related to the idea of penetration and division and making distinctions. So I think that begins to work its way up beyond the personal.
Yeah. In the first chapter of my book, I've described someone going into a numinous state where he's in a beautiful place in the countryside and he's relaxed, and he completely goes beyond himself, and he enters a place of great beauty where he feels at one with a cosmos, and the cosmos is all love, and he completely loses a sense of personal self. So that's quite rare. That's a very high level numinous state. But it's quite interesting, these states, the personal ego can just completely dissolve, can be transcended, and then you come back to it.
Right. It's reminiscent of Maslow's peak experience and a kind of Satori experience.
Yeah, very similar.
So I wanted to ask how your own experience with numinosity, I guess, and also how it's been helpful to you as a psychiatrist, the concept. That's two different questions, I guess.
Yeah, Yeah, it is. I mean, if I start with a personal experience, I guess one of the most illuminating experiences I had was in my first session of holotropic breathwork when I was working with Stan Grof. And I had an experience then a little bit like the one I've just described that seemed very authentic to me. And it seemed as though I had gone to a deeper reality. So it didn't seem like a drug state. It seemed realer than real. And it seemed to me that it seemed very clear to me that the basic message of all the scriptures and all the religions was essentially true. Although, of course, all the religions have their own take on it. And I'm not interested in religion at all. So that was hugely interesting for me because it opened up a whole new area of psyche that I knew that I didn't understand and I wanted to understand a little bit more. And then that connected in a way with clinical work in terms of giving me a better take on people with these really high intensity experiences that are usually called psychotic. And I felt beforehand that I was quite good at working with neurotic patients, but I wasn't so good at really engaging on the level I needed to with psychotic patients. So I started having some of these experiences, I could engage with them in a way that seemed a lot more useful. It seemed as though I could enter their territory at least to some extent and walk around it with them at least to some extent. I wouldn't want to overstate this. I'm not saying I became very good at it, but I started to develop some capacity to do that.
That was one of the things that attracted me to psychedelics in the mid-60s when I was a graduate student. Was feeling like, well, this would have the potential to expand my understanding of the range of consciousness, and certainly did. I mean, it took me to places that would have just been so abstract and theoretical to me, you know, but to really, boom, experience it as something different.
Yeah,
so I really understand that. Synchronicity, it seems to me, is also a very fascinating topic and maybe somehow related to the idea of the numinous. Maybe you can talk a bit about synchronicity and your own experience with it, both personally and, if it makes sense, clinically.
So synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence where there's a coming together of an internal event and an external event. And it's a really important concept because Jung and other people describe synchronicities. It's confirmed to them that that there's an aspect of consciousness which is external to our own psyche. So it tends to indicate that there's some intelligence in the cosmos around us, which is a real game changer. So very often having a synchronicity is a numinous experience because it really alters your perception of what the world is like and how consciousness is made up. You can have relatively minor synchronicities which will not take your breath away and major synchronicities which really will take your breath away. Often synchronicities occur at times. It might be a personal crisis, or it might be a time when you're particularly open, you know, often coming back from a meditation retreat or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Christina Groff always used to say that synchronicities were the universe's way of indicating that you're on the right track in some way.
Yes, I didn't know that they said that, but that's certainly somewhere I must have picked up that idea or come to that on my own.
Yeah, so I think synchronicities are a useful integrative mechanism, by which I mean they're helpful. They shift something in your psyche. So I gave an example of that in my book about my last day at Royal London Hospital, where I worked for 20 years. And it was really quite a nice time for me. I really enjoyed being with people and enjoyed doing the things I was doing for the last time and really felt quite open. And, you know, the colours were a bit brighter and, and then at the end of the last day, I handed in my keys and said my goodbyes. And I just went up to the top of the building, 14th floor, just to have a last look at the view and say goodbye. And then I was coming down in the lift, and for the first time ever, and I'd been using that lift for years, the lift got stuck. Got stuck at the 13th door, in that the door would open a little bit, but I couldn't get out. So it felt as though the hospital was not letting me go. And then somebody got in and went down another couple of floors, and then it happened again. It was a slight numinous moment for me. I wouldn't say it was a, you know, religious or spiritual experience, but I had this soft sense of awe that there's something going on here, which is a little bit beyond me every day. And what was important about it was it was just really helpful to me, because I was so glad to get out of that lift eventually that I scuttled through the doors, and it felt as though all my ambivalence about, you know, about saying goodbye and leaving had been resolved. And I was out of there.
Yeah. I love that story. And what it brings to mind right now are some group activities where in Gestalt therapy or some other context, somebody's trying to break through, and the group will form a circle, and the person will really have to break through. The group will resist, and in the process of breaking through, they get a powerful experience of, okay, I'm ready to let go. I've done it. I've broken through. Yeah.
Sounds a bit similar to a kind of rebirth experience. You see quite a lot of that in holotropic breath work. People seem to go back to a very early level of psyche when they're in the uterus and then being born. Of course, according to conventional psychoanalysis, consciousness and the psyche only starts when you are born, and you become this very sensitive infant who is exquisitely attuned to the nuance of your relationship with the breast. Whereas what you learn in these experiences is that actually consciousness starts a lot earlier than that. And, you know, we really retain an imprint of, you know, the very challenging journey through the birth canal to be born, or, you know, however it is we come into the world. And so these methods that, you know, you're describing, the breaking out, the and breaking out, I think maybe have something to do with that level.
You've had some psychedelic experiences, as I recall, from the book, and the first LSD experience that I had a profound sense of recognition of oh, yeah, I remember this place. And my sense of that was that it was childhood consciousness, that somehow I was experiencing things as I did when I was very, very young, and the world was all fresh and new.
Yeah. Well, psychedelics are coming back. I mean, I'm personally, I'm not very big on psychedelics. I don't really like mind-altering substances that much. I like a glass of red wine. I did experiment with psychedelics when I was a student, and I had all the normal sort of experiences. But for me, I never felt as though I broke through to anything transcendent. For me, it was always like finding myself up a mountain, you know, and the weather's coming in, and how do you get down again? Yeah, for me, it had more of that sort of quality.
Yeah,
so I guess that's why I've found myself much more drawn to the non-drug methods
I am not advocating drugs for anybody. I want to be clear about that. And that's just something that was part of my journey at a certain point. And it probably would have been good if I just had that one experience. Because the others were seeking to get back to that place. Of the first time, of that great aha.
Yeah.
And you can't go, as Thomas Wolfe said, you can't go home again.
You can't
get in the same river twice.
Yeah. Well, I was at an ayahuasca retreat just a couple of weeks ago. It was in the Netherlands, where it's completely legal. And this particular place got the reputation of being a very good setup. So in the spirit of inquiry, I wanted to go along and have a look. And I suppose I was interested to see how it compared to holotropic breathwork. There are a few things that surprised me about it. One was that it really does take you to the dark side. It really does show you your shadow. It had a kind of Kali-like energy, I felt. But it shows you things. But it really confronts the defences, whereas holotropic breathwork asks questions of the defences, but is unlikely to really overwhelm the defences. Occasionally it does. Because mm-hmm. ayahuasca doesn't take any prisoners at all in the high dose form. And I suppose the other thing that interested me about it was I thought it was fascinating, and it was a very well-run workshop. It was very interesting to see so many people working very hard on themselves in a very self-disciplined way. But here I am now, a week or two later, and I actually don't remember a lot of what happened, and I don't feel fundamentally changed by it. Maybe I'm a bit more than I think. Whereas when I was doing my holotropic breathwork training, the memories were crystal clear. And it felt as though the integration processes were they were much more developed. So I felt as though I had material to work on for months, you know, often for about 6 months, which I thought was interesting. But sometimes when I was doing holotropic breathwork, I felt maybe I wasn't going far enough. Maybe there were some defences that I had that just weren't being confronted enough, which is why the ayahuasca is potentially so useful.
Now, you went through an advanced training, transpersonal training with Stan Grof and using that method. And so I was really intrigued by that. I've had just sort of a beginning experience with it and been tempted to do a longer experience or training or something. But
recommend it.
Okay, you do recommend it. Yeah, I'd be interested to have you talk a little bit more about your experience with that, about the technology of it, since there may be viewers, listeners who aren't familiar with that.
Of holotropic breathwork?
Yeah.
Well, so holotropic breathwork is a non-drug method of having something similar to a mild to moderate psychedelic experience. You lie on a mat and you hyperventilate, and music is played very loudly. It's a certain type of archetypally evocative music. And the process lasts probably about 3 hours. You have a sitter who takes care of you. And then you're the sitter for the other person when they have their session. And I think it works best in a longer retreat, so maybe 5 or 6 days, so you can really remove yourself from the everyday world. You can step out of your normal ego, your normal way of being in the world, at least to some extent, and you can dive into the deep psyche. And what you're invited to do is just open up, just let your psyche be open, whatever, and whatever emerges. And whatever comes up, you make it bigger. If you have pain somewhere, you make it bigger. You see where it takes. If you have an emotion, you make it bigger. And you know, there's a whole range of experiences that people have. What attracted me to it was that I think it's a good organisation. It's very safe. Stan Grof has been doing this sort of work for 50 years or so. You know, he began as an LSD psychotherapist. Then when LSD became illegal in the mid-60s, he could no longer do his clinical research work. He developed holotropic breathwork as a way of continuing his work. So it's very well held. The people who run the workshops are very well trained. They will take care of you. And particular attention is paid to integration. So there's no point in having these experiences if you can't move some way. So yeah. It's all about being at home, so it's of some use.
Yeah.
I think Grof has really sort of nailed the integrating process to drawing, writing, sharing your experience with your sitter, group work, meditation, movement. Something comes up in your body which is really powerful. There are certain ways of doing a focused release to help you through that. And it seemed to me that it was a safe and useful way of getting to those more Jungian parts of the psyche, mm-hmm. you know, the really parts of the psyche which lie beyond memories and words. And then, of course, if you go through the training, you have a lot of experiences that you can't really explain using, you know, conventional psychology. You have experiences of birth process before the birth, maybe after death experiences, but there's a whole stack of ways in which you can interpret these experiences, and different people would have a different take on them.
Yeah. One of the things I was impressed by in your description of this was that they weren't shoving any particular interpretation down your throat. You know,
that, absolutely.
So that can be kind of rare in the world, right?
Sure, it is rare. I mean, you know, Stan Groff has got his theories, and you do hear about his theories. But there is completely no dogma. The other thing that's great about it is there's no therapizing. So if you're a facilitator of holotropic breath work, which I am, having done the training, you actually don't really do anything. You don't do anything clever. You don't say anything clever. You don't do anything clever. You just support the process and create a setting in which people do their own inner work,
Has that affected your clinical work? Do you find that you're more inclined to trust the process maybe than you were before?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, sometimes people do need some help. Sure. So holotropic breathwork is a particular circumstance where, you know, people have signed up to do this own inner work. In psychiatric practice, people have not signed up to do this own inner work. So, you know, they need a little bit more help. And some processes are more benign than others, of course. I mean, some psychiatric processes are not benign at all. Some people get into very difficult areas and really need some help and support and much proactive presence.
You've got a chapter titled Breaking Down or Breaking Through, and in it you discuss ideas, the idea of spiritual emergency. And so, as a psychiatrist, how do you distinguish between whether somebody's having a psychotic break or a spiritual emergency? I would think that'd be tricky.
That's a great question, and it's really difficult. And the short answer is that a lot of the time, you know, we don't really know. And there's probably a spectrum experience, and people would have a different take on it. And some people would think that all psychiatric disorder is a form of spiritual emergency and all you need to do is support the process. I do not believe that. I think there is such a thing as, you know, as mental illness that needs much more than simply support. So it's spiritual emergency, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder. So if you feel that you're on a journey, if you feel that you're on a spiritual journey, then you're on a spiritual journey. So I suppose one of the tasks is to try to help people to develop that mindset of personal growth, of personal adventure, the adventure of personal discovery. And then if people do develop that mindset, then you need to make sure that the environment is safe for them. So it's physically safe, you know, nothing bad's going to happen to them, but also give them some help with integrating their experience and making sense of it and bringing it back in a way that's useful. And sometimes you can do that, and sometimes, you know, you can't. You have somebody who's got a severe manic episode, and, you know, how are you going to find 10 people to give them round the clock care for the six weeks or so, whatever it takes? There are some guidelines as to symptoms which are less sinister. So the classical kind of Kundalini type crisis, you don't have the derogatory auditory hallucinations that you might have in that condition that we call schizophrenia. People tend to they might have much more physical sensations, sort of heat, some sensations that could be likened to manifestations of chakra-like energy. So there are some ways in which you can try to distinguish. But we need to do a lot more work on this.
Uh-huh. And, because sometimes it can start out very positive and flip, right, into the negative.
It's usually going to flip.
It's usually going to flip. Yeah,
I think it is, because in order to make the progress we need to make, we need to process some of the material that we haven't been able to process before.
The shadow material. Yeah.
Shadow. Yeah. And every growth tradition acknowledges the importance of working with shadow.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the shadow, you've got a subsection titled The Problem of Evil. So what's your take on the problem of evil? Well, it seems really relevant right now in the world.
Yes. Well, it's quite a short section because I don't really know. I mean, the usual answer that you would get is that evil is about unprocessed shadow, and the manifestation of evil gives us an opportunity to work with that. Mm-hmm. Ways in which we individually or collectively are destructive, are greedy, are envious, are hurtful. And because, of course, it's in our shadow, it's out of our sight, and we don't see it. So shadow tends to come up in ways that surprise us. Like, I guess, we can talk about what's happening in my country and your country and Europe and the world at the moment, and you could see it as a manifestation of our collective shadow. And if using that take, it's not all them, it's not that they're the bad primitive guys and we're the good guys. We're all in it together, and we really need to engage with it, which is difficult. We never really know how to do it. I think all we can do is be open, work on ourselves, have the intention, have compassion in our hearts.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you're speaking to that. You know, among the workshops that you've taken, I was interested in your discussion of Robert Monroe's Out of the Body work. Now, I knew of Robert Monroe because I had a graduate student. I was on his doctoral committee, and we've since been friends, who did his dissertation on Out of the Body. And so he was very wrapped up in Monroe's work. And that was years ago when he did that. I was surprised to discover that there's an ongoing body of work and stuff called a process called Gateway Workshops that you seem to be pretty positive about.
Yeah, so I've read Robert Monroe's books, and I thought he was a very interesting man. He was very different to the usual 50s, 60s explorers. He was not a hippie. He didn't take LSD. He was an engineer. And he started having these spontaneous out-of-body experiences. It took him to some very interesting places. And then he develops a technology using sound, using different frequencies of sound that seemed to develop these non-ordinary states. And he went on his own personal journey that he's written about in his three books, and was interesting. And he seems to go to the land of the dead, for example, describes different layers of consciousness. So I wanted to have a go at it. Uh-huh. And the Gateway course is the introductory course. It lasts about a week, and it's another well designed course. They've obviously taken a lot of time and trouble to develop it. And you just go into deeper and deeper areas of your psyche. And a lot of it is guided meditation type work, some similarities to shamanic journeying. Few people have out of body experiences. And if you want to take it further, there's a number of other different courses that you can do that take you to apparently progressively higher levels. I didn't do that. So what my strategy was to have a little taste of a whole load of things, but to really major in the growth training.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the way that you review a lot of these processes, and they make sense in terms of the whole spectrum of extreme extreme up, extreme down that you're investigating in your book. And you do go into shamanism. You mentioned the work of Michael Harner, who probably should be on my to-do list of somebody to interview, because I think he lives in my neck of the woods, more or less. I think he lives within 50 miles of where I am. And so,
well, it would be great if you get hold of him. I mean, I think he's a very great man. I think he's up there with Groff. I've never met him. I've done some work with people who he trained. And he's an extraordinary explorer of consciousness in the same way that, you know, Braff and Munro and other people have. And again, he's really developed a technology and a method that allows other people to follow in his footsteps. But I think what's remarkable about him is that he's been doing it for so long and he's gone so deeply. And his latest book, Cave and Cosmos, he hasn't written very much at all. But if you read Cave and Cosmos, it is the most extraordinary book.
Uh-huh.
It kind of flies under the radar. I'm surprised more people are not familiar with his work. So it'd be really great if you could get hold of it.
I think I should. I'll take that as encouragement to reach out to him. I have a friend who has taken some workshops with him within the last year or so, and he found it to be a positive experience. Well, I've kind of come to the end of what I had planned. I wonder, as we wind down, if there are any last points that you'd like to make.
I haven't mentioned the midlife crisis, the midlife transition, which I think is a really interesting area, because I think it's where there's ego structures that have served you well through the first part of life. Maybe some of those become a bit redundant. That's a real opportunity to open to something a little bit different. What interests me about it is that you find people in this midlife period who maybe have some symptoms of depression, and traditionally they're steered towards psychotherapists. But I think that's the wrong treatment. I think something which is more to do with opening to the deeper psyche, the sort of the things we've been talking about, is likely to be helpful.
So what are you doing with your time these days? If you retired from the East End work, are you in private practice? Are you retired? What's going on for you at this point in life?
I do some private practice. I have a publishing company, Muswell Hill Press. The idea is to find people who've really got something to say along the lines of what we've been talking about.
Okay.
His work hasn't, you know, his work needs some help to get out there. I'm a dad. My youngest is 16, so I like being a dad. So I do that. I like to write. Starting the Institute of Transpersonal Archetypal Studies, which is going to be a series of modules, again, to help people through the sort of areas that we've been talking about, personal growth.
Say that again, the Institute of?
Transpersonal and Archetypal Studies.
Okay, Transpersonal and Archetypal Studies.
We're probably going to call it ITAS for short.
Okay.
The idea is to give people the opportunity to have some theoretical teaching alongside powerful, safe, well-held experiential work. We're going to be starting out in London and hopefully get it going in New York as well.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best of luck with that and building that. I think in this book, you've certainly established that you've got a broad base, a broad and deep base of understanding to take that forward. So,
still learning.
That's great. That's great. Okay. Well, Dr. Tim Reed, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dave. Good night.
As you may have gathered from our conversation, I feel in many ways Dr. Reed and I are cut from very similar cloth. He's someone who has explored a wide variety of contemporary therapy and growth approaches, both from a rigorously intellectual standpoint as well as from a subjective experiential one. As a result, he's come up with what I think is a very balanced, sober synthesis that takes into account the best of what psychiatry has to offer, tempered by the insights of Jungian psychology and a growing body of transpersonal wisdom. I especially recommend his book for the chapters toward the end, which review psychedelic research focusing on MDMA and psilocybin, and going into some detail about the various experiential programs he's explored. His work is like a very tall pyramid, reaching very high and with a very broad, solid base. As always, you can order Dr. Tim Reed's book, Walking Shadows, Archetype and Psyche in Crisis and Growth, using the Amazon affiliate widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hello, my name is Patty. I'm a psychotherapist and Jungian analyst in the province of Ontario, Canada. I was introduced to Shrink Wrap Radio a little while ago and find the interviews certainly help to keep me on top of what is happening in the world of psychotherapy. As well, I love Dr. Dave's well-prepared, authentic approaches as an interviewer. I decided to make a monetary contribution recently because I want to be able to rely on the continuation of these valuable podcasts. And for this reason alone, I hope that other listeners do the same. Thanks again for providing such a great service. Bye for now.
Thank you, Jungian analyst Patty Brannigan, for that sterling endorsement and encouragement to others to help support Shrink Wrap Radio. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Patty Brannigan's call to action by acting? In fact, we have two new donors since the last show, Paul Rockwood and Jonathan Holmston. However, there are no new transcripts to announce today. Finally, let me remind you to use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar. You can use it to buy not only books, but anything under the sun that Amazon sells. That way we get a small percentage, and it's just another way that you can help to support the show.
Are you ready to all gather together all your heart, all your soul, all your anger, all your hate, and shout with me in group therapy, my brothers and sisters, my blood? Show me.
Yes, show me. Every now and then I need to dust that one off and play it. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. Synchronistically, it's from my very faithful listener, Mayar in Iran. I say synchronistically because Mayar has been much on my mind with this weekend's debacle of Donald Trump closing our borders to 7 Middle Eastern countries, including Iran. Yes, folks, we are winning hearts and souls around the world. So I guess you know how I'm feeling about that. At any rate, Mayar writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I hope you are doing all right. Many thanks for the 2017 interviews. I particularly enjoyed your interview with John Fredrickson. Have I told you that his book, Co-Creating Change, was translated into Persian some time ago? Beside Dr. Gorbani, a Persian professor whom I interviewed some time back, there are quite a number of other clinicians who practice ISTDP here in Iran, and John Fredrickson is quite famous here, especially given that he's held some workshops in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, which is almost 2 hours of flight from Tehran. Besides, your interview with Sergei Baranov was very thought-provoking. They actually use psychedelics there? Really? I should tell you that I've never tried something like that at all. I've never smoked a cigarette even. But this is not the case in Iran, for sure. As I've heard from people around, psychedelics are not such a rare thing, even among very young teenagers at school. He may be referring to other parts of the world, I suspect. I'm not sure. He goes on to say, besides the picture you put on the site for Sergei's interview, brought with it loads of good memories. In that picture, he's holding a male kestrel in his hand. I was actually hoping you'd talk about it as well. Is he a falconer? Anyway, I used to be one, and I had a kestrel as well. Mine was a female. Those days, I went to secondary school, and I was crazy about nature and birds of prey. I got my hands on a copy of Emma Ford's Falconry in Muse and Field, and it became my guide into how to practice falconry in a 4-stairway building with 16 flats in the east of Tehran. I had to finally set my bird free. It became clear day by day that a basement is not a place to keep a kestrel, even though I brought her out every day for at least 1 or 2 hours of flight. I felt that she needed much more than that, and hence took her to the suburbs outside Tehran with my father and set her free with watery eyes. I never forget those days. Unfortunately, I don't have any pictures with her. I didn't have a camera back then, and my memory is the only place I refer to find her. And many thanks for sharing Trevor's story. He's referring to email from Trevor Ehrman that I read last week about his kind of career change, evolution from postman to a drug counselor. And Mayar goes on, it was indeed fascinating. He should have made such a big decision and undertaken a real transformative journey. I can tell you that I was very moved, and I want to ask you that if you happen to have any more correspondence with him again, please let him know that a psychology student in Tehran sends him his regards and wishes him the best and hopes that he makes it all the way that he wants. His story was really inspiring. And quite a lot of news about the recent changes in the U.S., no? But I'm still positive that these issues, especially with visas for Iranians, would be something temporary and things would go back to normal. Much longer than usual, sorry. All the very best, and that's from Mayar. Mayar, I so appreciate your writing, and I'm glad that everything is well on your end. I hope things go back to, quotes, normal, and I'm upset about what's going on right now. I have to tell you, it's a turbulent time of change, is all we can say. I was really excited to hear about your past experience as a falconer. That's really cool. I recently saw a movie in the theater about a little girl in Mongolia who becomes a falconer with eagles. I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it's called The Eagle Huntress. And she won a contest where only males had ever been able to practice that sport. And she won, and it's a really wonderful movie. I don't know if you'll be able to find it there in Iran, but if you can, I know that you'll love it. And let's see what else in your email that did I want to touch base with. I guess those are the main points. Actually, I guess I do want to respond to your remark about psychedelics. Even though I do discuss psychedelics on episodes from time to time, I am in no way advocating them for you or for others. I think you should just keep to the very clean lifestyle that you've been living. With that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Tim Reed, MD, for discussing his work and his fascinating book, Walking Shadows, Archetype and Psyche in Crisis and Growth. Next week's guest will be Guy McPherson, an Oakland, California psychologist specializing in adolescent trauma and early psychosis therapy, and he's also the founder of the Trauma Therapist Project and host of the Trauma Therapist Podcast. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.